Hey guys, welcome back to the Business of Cyber. If you've been enjoying the show and aren't already a subscriber, be sure to follow along. If you're on Spotify, you'll see a follow button on the Business of Cyber main page. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, you'll see a plus and a follow button at the top right side of the main page. It's the best way to get notified of new episodes, and it helps me out as we grow the show. Now, my guest today is Rishi Bhargava, the co-founder of Descope. Descope is an authentication and user management startup who made a huge splash earlier this year when they announced their $53 million seed round led by Lightspeed. Before founding Descope, Rishi and many of the same core team from Descope sold to Misto to Palo Alto Networks for $560 million in 2019. With this background, you can imagine we had a lot to discuss. This was a very wide-ranging conversation from go-to-market experiences to product design best practices and his approach to hiring. We also covered the personal side of entrepreneurship and explored how Rishi handles expectations and pressure that comes along with founding a high-profile company. I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation.
Well, the party is off to a good start.
Rishi, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
Thanks, Joe. Doing very well and excited to be on the show.
Good. Likewise. Excited to have you here. Well, I'd love to start with maybe a little bit of context. So could you please kick us off with just sort of your background and how you found your way into the world of cybersecurity and startups?
Yeah, absolutely. So going back, what, about 23 years, I did my engineering. Came to US for my master's, and my first job out of USC was technically a startup, but it was a public company. Back in the day, like this was 2000, a small public company was run like a startup. The growth was crazy. And that was my introduction to professional life. And it wasn't a good one. I always give this as an experience, says, hey, joining in end of 2000 or early 2001 for a fresh grad is like jumping into the deep end of the pool and not knowing what you are signing up for. Of course, the world started to collapse, all the market, all the dot-com bust that was happening back then. And I spent a couple of years at my first job and then moved into another startup. So I think I have either worked for a startup all my life or got acquired into a big company via startup and then went back to startup. So that's how it has been. In terms of cybersecurity, I think, yes, the second job that I joined in 2003 was a cybersecurity company. This was December of 2003. And since then, I've been in cybersecurity in different spaces from endpoint to other spaces like application security, security operations, and so on.
I'm always curious to understand for folks who have been a part of the cyber and startup ecosystem for a long time and have seen evolutions from both small companies and big companies, sort of the similarities and differences in running a company today versus running a company, for example, in the early to mid 2000s. So how do you think about those similarities and differences?
So I think The big similarity is, I think, in some senses, cyber has not changed, which is anybody building a company in cybersecurity still needs to worry about that you're always in this cat and mouse game, which is the bad guys are going to innovate, then you need to innovate to protect against the problem that they are creating and so on and so forth. So I think that part has not changed. And I think, honestly, that's the most exciting part for me, which is at each stage, you are thinking, how can somebody get around what I'm protecting? How can they find a loophole? And then how can I protect against a loophole? So that's the very exciting part. Now, what has changed is, I think cybersecurity, people say, has been always an evergreen market, but not really. If you think about it, early 2000 or mid 2000, cybersecurity was doing well, but it was still one of those spaces where there were two or three categories. There was endpoint, there was network security, and that's about it. Everything in the endpoint got merged into it. In fact, I remember early, even in 2010, 2011, McAfee's business, which is where I was, got acquired into McAfee. There were two big, large businesses. Everything else was part of these two, endpoint and network. That's it, right? And then there was a management BU, which was managing the management software. Now, if I look at cybersecurity, oh my God, right? It's like I cannot even keep everything straight from supply chain to application security to the endpoint to the identity to every different aspect. So it has grown, and that growth came with its own challenges for somebody running a company in cyber, which is how do you differentiate? How do you navigate? So hyper-competitive also makes it hard for the practitioners to choose a solution and wish. And I think that's the biggest challenge I feel is like, how do you evaluate a security product?
Yeah. I'd love to maybe pivot a bit into, I know how we got connected through Pramod and understanding just sort of off the heels of the announcement and the launch of Descope. So what was sort of the background or the context for how you've come to found Descope recently?
Yeah, I think Descope and even Demisto, my previous company, was a founder or the team first and idea later. And I think that's like, from my perspective, that is a beautiful thing because all of us founders work together for a long time, love working with each other, know each other very well. So it's really fun to start something new. About the idea on Descope, I think it all came around because we said, okay, we're going to do something. And then we sat and looked at different spaces. And one of the criteria was, let's find a problem that is big enough, has been around for long, and if we solve it, it has a huge impact. And if you look at cybersecurity, passwords is that problem. Like literally, I see is like, if you ask anybody what goes back 30, 40 years in security, it's like the password. And that continues to be the problem. Last year, if you look at the Verizon database, Verizon data breach report, which is amazing report, 80% of the attacks are related to identity or password problems. So that was one factor. Second, I think a little bit personal factor is Slavik, our CEO, my co-founder, tells the story, which is all of us realize that we are the IT experts for our families. And we constantly run into this, which is, hey, forgot this password, reset this. And he says, use a password manager. Aware kids, aware family, but still password managers do not do a thorough job. They do not autofill, sometimes override the existing password. So it started by saying, let's build a better password manager. And it says, no, wait, but why a password manager? Can we have an alternate? Can biometric be the only authentication? Can OTP plus biometric be the only authentication? And then we started to brainstorm on these ideas that why should an application today even have a password? Of course, there's some core things that will need a password, but can everything else work without a password, work with an OTP on the phone, work with the biometric on the phone? So that's how it came around from a personal and a real big problem, finding that common theme.
You know, I've heard about some other organizations that sort of brand themselves as passwordless, right? And that's sort of the problem they're going after. So, you know, given you mentioned it, I'm curious to understand what sort of Descope's edge or the way that you're doing it that's different that will make you guys stand out.
Yeah, no, great question, Joe. I think first of all, I'm really happy that everybody else is trying to solve the same problem, right? I mean, I truly believe, and I tell this to anybody who I advise or consult in the startup ecosystem, says if you don't have competition, then you are after the wrong problem because you're not the only smartest person in the room, right? I think that's an important thing to understand. So I'm glad others are trying to solve the problem. I think our realization or aha moment was that if we need to make world passwordless, we need to go after the developers who are building the application and make it very, very easy for them to build applications without passwords. So I think our hyper focus is how do we enable developers to build passwordless applications? Now, if that is the goal, one of the things that is very, very clear is you need to make it developer friendly, very high modularity, flexibility, documentation. But then our entire background at Demisto was workflows, no-code approaches to solving complex situations, which was security operations. And we said, if I look at a user journey inside of an application, it's not just the login. Login is a very small piece of it. That is where it starts. And even within login, if I take that Lego box of login, I can blow it up to say, hey, login means where is the user coming from? Is it a new device? Is it the device we have seen before? Which geo are they coming from? Does the authentication method depend on the geo they are coming from? And this is literally a workflow. So the core innovation at Descope is we have designed a workflow engine. You can come in and say, if the user is coming in from this geo, then use this as the authentication method. If they're coming in from this geo, then come and use this authentication method. And if the risk is high or it is a new device, enable an MFA. All of these pieces, if you really sit down and code today for an application developer, is months and months of work. And with us, you can literally design this as a workflow and embed this in a workflow, embed this in your app. And that's the core piece, which is how can I shrink that time and still give the modularity and flexibility?
I'm curious, as you guys were sort of sitting around the table, right? You mentioned starting with team, and then once you had the team sort of assembled, determining what problem you wanted to solve for. When this came up, was there concern about some of the large players that are already in the identity and authentication space? Or did you feel, all right, we've got a unique enough approach, or we can move faster than them, so it wasn't as much of a concern?
Yeah, I think it's the same, to be honest, Joe. This time we wanted a space which has large players. We wanted a space which is big enough to disrupt somebody. I mean, the reality is that there are some very well-established players, good solutions out there, but I don't think they are good enough to solve the problem yet, right? I mean, penetration-wise, people are still developing their entire authentication stack.
Yeah.
Still taking months, like multiple. We interviewed north of 100 customers. I think close to 105, 110 customers we have interviewed in while figuring out this whole problem and building the early versions of Descope. And it's very clear that a good number of those still take months, even using the existing solutions, and then stitch these together. Mm-hmm. And that's still the problem. I mean, why should an application developer worry about this at all? Why should they take months? So I don't think there was a concern that there are large players. I think it was an acknowledgement that there are large players. There was absolutely, I think it almost was a positive thing that there are large players, which means there is money to be made, which means there is a big problem to be solved when we looked at the space over the last year.
That sparks a sort of go-to-market question. You know, I'm curious how you think about, you know, large organizations, right? Enterprises who may be working with one of those large players that sort of maybe somewhat entrenched. How do you think about getting them to sort of compelling action, right? Getting them to change and sort of adopt a new way to manage identity?
Yeah. So I think a couple of things here, right? First, I think from my perspective, the go-to-market is ties very strongly with your product. So what I mean by that is we are building a product that's easy to use, easy to try, and go see if it adds value. So I think step one is we are really targeting to build something that people can try within a day or 2 days or at most a week and see, oh, the entire thing works, the entire thing is built. And that is kind of the crux of the go-to-market. So our thinking is that And by the way, validated with a lot of large customers already. I mean, even now, and we've been out of stealth for less than 2 months, in fact. And we have seen some very large organizations come to us on their own. Developers in those organizations, because it's a project, looked at the documentation, tried the product with very little handholding from us, and be able to do a successful POC within a matter of days to week. My point is, I think one of the go-to-market is I want to prove to the user, not the buyer, that it's easy to build. Then, of course, the buyer needs to trust us. We are still a startup compared to large organizations, but that's where our background comes in. I mean, this team has probably built, if you think in security, we have built products which have hundreds of millions of dollars in ARR revenue, very successful products. And I think we are bringing, says, hey, the expert team building and thinking about security and scaling problems, but at the same time, the product is super easy to use. It's like you go in, you try it, it works, and it will scale with you. So I think it's kind of a dual go-to-market, make it easy for the developers and then go earn the trust of the buyer. Still early in the day. I mean, I'm not going to say, hey, we have sold a lot. But I think that's a journey. We are seeing some amazing, amazing traction. And a lot of the people who chat with us give us the benefit of doubt in the sense of our credibility of what we delivered with Demisto. So I'm seeing a lot of our past customers engage with us, give us the love, says they love the product. So it's like, okay, let's see what you're building now.
Yeah, very cool. What would your advice be on that second point? You mentioned earning the trust of buyers. And I know a lot of startups struggle with that. Obviously, you guys have the success story of Demisto and the credibility that comes with that. But I'm curious, if you maybe have an investment or a CEO that you're mentoring, how would you advise them if they're struggling in that area in terms of maybe a successful POC with some users and now they've got to go earn the trust of the buyers?
I think they, and again, we did this in Demisto, right? I mean, yes, now we use some of that success here. I feel looking back at the Demisto's lessons and learnings, what was most important, Joe, was the transparency and being upfront about the value and also understanding the customer's challenge. If you look at any early adopter, right? I mean, big fan of Crossing the Chasm book. I've read it multiple times, almost read it every 2 years to refresh the basic principles. I truly believe that book is like full of so many lessons you cannot absorb in one reading. But fundamentally, if I think about it, you got to understand your early adopters' pain point really, really well, right? And earning the trust will be a function of saying, we solve your pain point very well. Prove that. And then stand by the buyer as they deploy it. People underestimate the customer success and the deployment path a lot, right? I mean, to me, you never get the first deal as your big deal. It's like, okay, let's give you a small trial. Let's start here. And if you're able to deliver and show the success, then you earn the trust. Another important thing I kind of tell all founders and all CEOs is do not underestimate the power of you as founder touching the customer yourself. And the customer in this case, it's not just the CISO you need to talk to. You need to talk to that developer, to that security engineer. And I truly believe that. And we learned a lot, like early days of Demisto. And even now, I'm going hands-on working with the engineer, with the security engineer or the developer, engaging with them because you understand their pain point so much better. And then that is where you earn the trust. When the security engineer feels that the founding team themselves are engaging with me, that means I'm important to them. And then you build brick by brick is how I say it. It's like, go start with that foundation, work with them, earn the trust. They will be your champion. they go talk about you. I still remember, as like first of one of our early customers at Demisto, worked with them directly, maintained that relationship. Every problem that they faced through, even through the acquisition with Palo Alto of Demisto, we were there for them.
You mentioned some lessons learned from the experience with Demisto. I'm curious, you know, as you kind of reflect on the experience, you've already mentioned a couple, but what were some of the main inflection points throughout the, you know, the origin story and subsequent acquisition for Demisto?
Yeah, so some good inflection points. I think Demisto was an amazing journey. If you look at it from outside, by the way, everybody thinks like, oh my God, these guys from day one were doing so amazing. Of course, there were challenges in the middle when we look at the company journey. One of the big inflection point was, I call figuring out what the actual product and the product plan is, or the product strategy is. What do I mean by that? When I look at it, when we started, there were few players who were already building security orchestration automation piece. There was a company that was already acquired by IBM, Resilient Systems, which were doing security ticketing. And then Slack was very popular for communication. One of our early realization was, if you look at the pain points, and this came from interviews of customers that we did, when you go sit down, look at the problem that the security engineer is trying to tackle, and this is the actual user, not the buyer, the problem lies somewhere where all these three things intersect. You need automation, you need a ticketing system which is tied into the automation, and then you need collaboration piece. So I think one of the inflection point was us realizing that you cannot just solve automation and leave the ticketing system aside. You cannot just build a ticketing system and leave the automation in a separate thing. Can we bring this together? So that was a big moment to bring this together. We were able to differentiate from our competition, change the game, so to say, to play on our turf rather than their turf. Says, hey, you need these together. And then it's like, okay, now I need to go build something else. Second inflection point was, I think we underestimated in the early days of Demisto the importance of user experience and the UI of building these playbooks and workflows. So our first revision, by the way, of the playbooks was not as good as it should have been. Good news there is we were open-minded. We listened to the feedback. We listened to the customer feedback. We analyzed the lost deals data and says, okay, this is a gap for us. Let's go quickly fix it. And then the entire team realized it and fixed it. And I think to me, that was the moment of coming together. It was not engineering and sales and marketing and pointing fingers. Like, guys, let's look at what the problem is. Why are we not winning these deals? We came together, we fixed it, and then we turned it around. So that was a big inflection point. And then the third one I would put is sales and go-to-market efficiency and teams, right? I mean, we focused a lot on, can we continuously improve the sales, right? Where are the leads coming from? How can we cater to them really well? How do we respond to these people? How can we shorten the POC? How can we implement the customer really fast so that they become a reference? So literally that whole journey of go-to-market, we kept like improving so that we get the most efficiency and do much better job at that entire life cycle.
When I was getting ready for the interview over the past couple of days, I found an older interview you had done where you had said, if I remember correctly, it was during a 3-month period in sort of the preparations for founding Demisto, you entirely shifted the direction of the product based on what you heard from the customers or prospects in these interviews. So I'm curious to understand just sort of how you think about maintaining the balance of incorporating customer and user feedback into the product, but also sort of remaining focused on your product vision. So how do you sort of maintain the balance between those two?
So this is a trick. I think I might be very different from many other founders, or us. We all founding team may be very different than other people out there. So first of all, that story of changing the whole thing is before we actually started Demisto. That's like a story. Is like, how did the idea came to be? We went out there, says this is what we want to build. And people said, no, don't do this. Here is something else we want you to build. So we were not stickler about any vision. There was like, okay, we want to build this, but we said, no, that's okay. We're going to change it if you want us to change it. So I think it's almost what does the customer want? But I think after you start, if you put a line in sand and say, this is what we are building, I still feel that we as a team value customer feedback more than our own opinion. Now, but you've got to be careful, right? I mean, you've got to understand the feedback from the customer and the why behind the feedback from the customer, not just the feedback. So if a customer says, I want this, that's not important. You need to understand why does the customer want this? What is the real problem? And you need to do that introspection into why is a customer wanting a certain thing. That's what will tell you what to go build. So the reality is, I don't think we kind of stuck on the vision, right? It's okay to change the vision if the customer's needs are completely different is my answer. But don't build a product because customer A said this, then B said this, then C said this, and mix all the features. You need to understand the real pain point and the common pain point across the customer. So me, be more deliberate, write down your interviews, read those interviews again. Don't be shy to ask why to the customer when they says, I want something. It's like, no, hold on. Don't tell me what you want. Tell me why you want it. Tell me what's the problem. It's okay. I mean, try to understand that better and the customers will be happy to share the real problem. So that's, I think, the critical in that journey of finding what to build.
You said something else in that interview that I wanted to talk to you about as well, essentially alluding to the ups and downs that are inevitable with life and running a startup. It's one of my least and most favorite things as well, where, you know, you could have a call where it goes extremely well. They say, yes, we're definitely moving forward. And then 2 hours later, a different customer says, hey, we're going with a competitor, right? Just the ups and downs that are.
Yeah.
So how do you personally manage these inevitable ups and downs? Like, how do you sort of disassociate, or, you know, just what do you do to manage it?
I think, first of all, it's not easy. I kind of live by two things, which is startup is a lifestyle rather than a job or rather than as a career choice, right? You really got to adopt it. And yes, it's a sine wave. You're right. I mean, it's almost hourly basis sometimes, daily basis sometimes. But I think the thing that I try to do, and I'll be honest, it's not perfect. I think it's still, by the way, even now, right? I mean, you would think it's like, hey, you guys did amazing with the previous one. Descope was a good start, good funding. It should be all rosy. No, not really. Never is, right? I mean, there are always challenges to find the right product, find the right customer. The way I think about it is the following. From my perspective, and this is more managing your own expectations, is how I call it, which is, are you taking the feedback? Are you analyzing what's not working? And are you improving on a regular basis? That's more important. Easier said than done, but kind of the only way to recover from what didn't go right is go quickly look at what did you not do right and improve it. Don't dwell over it. I think the problem that I face is most of the people, the problem that I see is most of the people dwell over it too much. You got to analyze it, but now you got to move on and say, how do I do this better next time? And be aware of what you didn't do right and continue to improve with every step. I truly say is you're not going to get it right the first time. I think nobody gets it right the first time. whether it's marketing, whether it's sales, whether it's product, you just don't. The point is, can you improve and not be overly self-critical, but at the same time, learn from your mistake?
You know, sort of on that subject about learning from mistakes and not dwelling on anything, are there examples of mistakes that you or the rest of the founding team did within Demisto that maybe hurt in the moment? You know, you wish they didn't happen, but in retrospect, you kind of are glad that they are because it taught you an important lesson. Do any mistakes like that come to mind?
Yes, I think definitely one of the ones it's always hiring is a very tough thing in a startup. I think there's two types of hiring mistakes I would say we felt we did. One is sometimes hiring too late. There are certain roles which you should say, okay, let's go hire right now. And you hired too late. There were certain types of roles where we should have realized like, hey, do it now. But we didn't do it just because we didn't think ahead. We didn't plan better. So that's one thing. Is in a startup, you got to plan when do you need what kind of role and how do you plan ahead. So that's one. Second is hiring the wrong person or the wrong type of person. I think hiring early employees, what's more important is to match the personality and the attitude than the skill. Right? Like I am a firm believer in attitude and aptitude comes before the skill, which is if you have a person who is like you, passionate, will learn, can do anything, will be empathetic to everybody or customers' needs, that's more important than does the person know exactly, does the person come from security sales background, does the person know a particular coding language? Those could be acquired and learned if they have the right attitude. So I think some of the early thing is like we didn't pay attention to the attitude when hiring, and that were challenges there as well.
Yeah. I'd love to dig into those too. So, you know, on the first point, and obviously it varies by the stage of the company, the role, but maybe just using Descope as an example, how do you think about the right time for certain critical hires, like a head of sales, a head of marketing, a head of engineering, those types of roles? Like at what point, like what do you need to see for those roles to make sense?
Yeah, I think different answer for different roles, but like, for example, somebody, a head of sales, in my opinion, people have, again, different philosophies, run it differently. I think in this one, it's almost no right or wrong. Some of the founders will say, no, I want a sales expert early on, and that's perfectly fine. But I am a believer that the first few sales need to be done by the founding team. And the reason is that you learn a lot when you do those early sales. And it's not just one sale. You need to do a variety of early sales, not from your network. Go out of your network, customers who came to you or cold call, because then you will really understand what is the value of the product, what is the right pitch that works, what is the pitch that does not work, what is the sales cycle like. What does it take to sell? Is your POC easy enough? Is your POC hard enough? Because otherwise, you're going to bring in a head of sales and they're going to learn on this stuff. And one of the two things that happen, which is one, either they get frustrated and leave because early on, they're going to face all these challenges and say product is not ready, which by the way, in early days may not be ready. Or you are going to be frustrated with them by saying it's like you're not making enough progress. But the reality is it's not the person's fault. It's just there is laws of physics here. You need to go out there. You need to meet the full customer, learn it, improve the process, improve the product, improve the pitch, the value prop, and then you find the right fit. So I think that's that. Same with the marketing. I think early on, marketing talent needs to be a very strong product marketing person who can tweak the messaging, understand product somewhat with product background to understand the product. Later on, you will hire somebody who's demand gen. But if you hire a demand gen person early on, they're not going to be able to focus on the product messaging, which is the most critical piece in the early on. So different role functions. But I think just be deliberate about thinking. I think the biggest mistake people make is they don't think. If they're deliberate about thinking, then you'll make the right decision. But be deliberate about the hiring the at the right time.
Now, for the second point you said as well about not just considering someone's skill set, but their personality and their attitude and aptitude. I had another founder I talked to fairly recently who said something similar. And we had a good discussion about sort of evaluating a candidate's attitude. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how you actually do that during the interview process, because it can be challenging, right? You may not get a true feel for someone's personality. Like the example that I heard that I was given in this last conversation is she said, everyone says they're a team player, but you don't really know until you get into a dynamic where you've got to work with them in a team. So how do you think about evaluating attitude and personality in an interview process?
I think maybe this is one of those answers, Joe, which I really don't know. I think to me, there are no questions to do that, which is why I think you will make some hiring mistakes, and we have made hiring mistakes. But I think I'll quote one of my early mentors, my first startup, as I was saying, the security startup. The CEO said, there was one hire we made. This guy came in. He was a fresh grad, and we hired him as an engineer, number three or four, as like, but this guy is like coming from a university fresh grad. You're going to give him to write this deep piece of code. Why is that? And his answer was, I like his hairdo. It's like, what? It's like his hairdo. And I was also young in my career. It's like, what does that even mean? It's like, I don't know. It just feels right. And I think to me, the one thing I do for hires is I really spend time with them. And try to talk to them. And I think it's very important to me that conversation should not feel forced, should not feel made up. If you're able to sit and talk about things, banter, non-work, work, understand what they like, what they don't like, that's important, right? I mean, you will be able to judge the person better that way rather than ask a question, are you a team player, right? And then the second is references say a lot. So early in the startup, I'm a believer, try to hire from your network and try to, if you don't hire from the network, that's okay, but try to go talk to the reference and ask open-ended questions. It's like, okay, what do you think about this person? What do you think impressed about them, impressed you about them? So go open-ended and broad in your conversations. Go open-ended and broad in your reference checks. Those are some of the tips, but it's hard. I completely agree. It's hard to judge.
Yeah,
the attitude from team player to passion to other things, but that I think is what I would suggest.
Yeah. Now, a couple of other sort of final questions before we move into the rapid fire round. I'm curious to and forgive the sort of more personal question here. I'm curious to sort of understand, as you think about Descope as it currently is, right? Like you said, just a few months out of stealth. Pretty high profile, large seed round that just got recently announced. Probably pretty high expectations, right? Especially coming out of the success with Demisto. What's it like for you, and how do you sort of manage the expectations?
I'd say my wife and my kids keep me grounded, bring me down, like, pull me down. No, I'm kidding. I think the real answer, Joe, is I'm a believer. It's like when you're feeling really big about yourself or good about yourself, look above. There's always somebody else you could try to be and be a better person, build a better company. And when you're feeling low, it's like look at others to say, hey, I'm a better position than them. I'm more fortunate than them. Come a long way. But I think the real answer is, I think to me, the funding and other aspects are not measures of success. I'll be honest. I think what I really feel proud about D-Scope is the early feedback from customers, the early success that we have gotten as the customers are using the product. And that's I think what I look at. I think it's very important to put your compass and your measure on the right measures of success. That's the most important thing. And define those as metrics of success and continue to improve over time with those. That's one. And two, I think, yes, we have very high expectations of ourselves is the first thing. And goes back to what I said earlier. And the only way to manage those is put the right metrics and keep improving on them and say, are we doing right on these things? If not, what can I do to get better at this? What can I do to better at this? We have an internal scorecard and we maintain ourselves and grade ourselves very harshly on those. Maybe score ourselves red in some areas, yellow. So I think it's important to, the best way to judge expectations is to judge yourself. I think to build yourself a scorecard and say, how are you doing? And manage that.
Good. All right, Rishi. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Let's go ahead and pivot into the rapid fire round, which basic premise is I ask a couple of quick questions and you share whatever comes top of mind. Sound good?
Cool.
All right.
Ready.
First question, what's your favorite book? You already mentioned Crossing the Chasm, so maybe another.
Crossing the Chasm, yeah. Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
All right, if you could change one thing about the security industry, what would it be?
I would change the evaluation criteria of how practitioners evaluate the product. I think bring more objectivity there somehow.
What's the best piece of career advice that you've ever received?
I think that's a hard one. I think a few career advice, but I would say what I received was be true to yourself and go pursue what you really like.
Cool. And the last one, if you could go back in time and get a drink with your 20-year-old self, what advice would you give him?
I would say be even more bold and take bigger chances.
Love it. All right, Rishi, well, it's a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, Joe. It was fun.